there's a lot of comparisons between the 2016-17 and our current cycle. The way I would describe 2016-17, very spot driven. We didn't actually have derivatives. Stablecoins really weren't a significant, I think Tether existed, but it's tiny. It was a very spot driven market. There's no futures, there's no options. It's just people buying Bitcoin, very much an adoption driven cycle. I really want to experience a parabola like that because probably one of the most epic price parabolas that will ever exist. The framework here is that every dip was bought, but every dip was quite severe and it came back down, retested the short-term holder cost basis, which is what we can see here. We are in a very much the same environment, right? We're getting these nice moderate rallies, nice corrections, moderate rallies, cool down, moderate rally, cool down. About 120 to 150. That is what I would call the topping cloud. We can absolutely bust out the top end of that with a very, very low probability of staying out the top end of that, right? So that's the way I like to think about it. At about 120, the average guy is quite profitable. At 150, the average guy is so profitable that in every previous cycle, he was cashing out. And above that, that's really speculative fever. And I probably would think if we go above it, we probably come back down through it.
Yeah, so welcome back on the show, man. Good to have you.
Thanks, man. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. So we were just talking a little bit beforehand about all the pandemonium that's happening, some of the topics we're going to cover. It's going to be a really full-throated episode today. Lots of stuff to cover. I appreciate you, making the time over in Australia. I'm on the East Coast for people who may be listening, so there's a huge time difference. So really great to have you on now. Your latest post on Substack, and you also tweeted about this, I believe, is it's chaos is back. That was your latest post. Trump's company obviously launched a meme coin. They owned 80% of the supply. And fun fact, it was the fastest value creation event in history. So it reached like a $15.5 billion market cap from zero in 30 hours, which is the fastest value creation event in history. And so given this, like, what are all your thoughts? What are your expectations for crypto given the launch of this meme coin? Is it just going to continue devolving into a casino, which leaves Bitcoin as the only valuable thing in the space, which it always has been? How do you think this unfolds?
No, it's fascinating, right? So, a lot of people are trying to work out, as an Australian, I kind of watch the US political arena from afar. I have no say in the matter. It's just kind of watching the movie unfold. And I think, there's no question we're going for a period of change. There's change going on geopolitically, regulatory, policies, the whole lot. There's a whole lot of things that are shifting, and they're not shifting a little bit, they're shifting a lot. And there's always a lot of questions of how is Trump going to handle this new regime? Like, what's it going to look like? As a base case, it's not going to be worse than the previous administration, right? They're going to be more favorable. They were openly hostile in the previous. So all things being equal, it should be more favorable. But then you're like, okay, but how favorable are we talking about? And there's a point where you're like, launching meme coins gives you a flavor of what this is going to look like. It's probably going to be pretty loose and gung-ho. And as a result, you're like, okay, well, I've got to look at a whole bunch of different indicators here. Say, well, what does this really mean for me as a Bitcoin holder and as someone who just lives in the world? You start seeing gold moving higher. You start seeing Bitcoin moving higher, and you're like, okay, that's telling us that they're probably going to be pretty relaxed and just let the cannons go, right? So almost run this economy hot. Don't worry too much about, if they're going to pump meme coins. It's that kind of financial nihilism coming into the fore. So look, it's probably giving us a bit of a flavor of what's to come. At the end of the day, I think that the meme coin phenomenon is fascinating. I did a podcast interview with Murad, who's kind of right at the forefront of this stuff. And not because I have any interest, edge, or really care about meme coins, but I find it an interesting social experiment. I've always found altcoins an interesting social experiment. And in my view, the meme coin phenomena is kind of the full-scale acceptance that crypto really has delivered stablecoins and very little else. And when you come to that realization that we've got Bitcoin, stable coins, and then basically people just punting on stuff, it's really an admission of that final state of affairs, which is, well, I'm going to buy Trump because I want to vote for Trump, right? It's purely just a mimetic concept that, there's nothing actually there, but people know there's nothing there. So, it's a really interesting, it's kind of a condemnation of crypto, but at the same time, it's very human nature. You can see how this stuff comes to be. It's not a good thing, but it is the movie that we're watching.
That sounds about right. It feels like for the longest time, all of these different, developers, the people who launched these other cryptocurrencies, they tried to mask it as if there was like some utility or some project going on. But now it seems that, you know, over the years, is basically all of those have come and gone. Ethereum is the only one that's been here for years and years and years now. It seems like this transition to meme coins being the most traded things that aren't Bitcoin is just an admission that, okay, yeah, no, these are just gambling tokens. We're being very self-aware about it now. And yeah, you did in one of your latest tweets, you talked about Ethereum being the Ethereum experiment. ETH BTC is having an awful time. You know, and this plays into what we were just talking about, right? You know, the value of Bitcoin relative to everything else. And ETH BTC, we did this over at TBL for the longest time, but that was one of our main barometers for, you know, the shitcoin index, right? It's dominance relative to Bitcoin. And during a bull market, ETH BTC has done nothing but underperform, particularly since last July. Trump announced at the Bitcoin conference, the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve. I think he called it something different at the time. And almost to the day or to the week, Ethereum detached from Bitcoin. And Ethereum has been underperforming since the start of 2024 to today. Ethereum's up like 44%. Bitcoin's up like 135%, something like that. So what do you have to say about ETH BTC? Does it basically, you know, is that like the main barometer for what you just explained, that, you know, all of this stuff is basically coming to the fore now, that none of this has any value, it's just a gambling scheme?
So something I've been really interested in watching this cycle is Bitcoin's barely had a 25% correction. The deepest that we've had was 32, and that was like for 3 hours in early August when the yen carry trade wiped out. So really, Bitcoin has barely pulled back. And yet I've observed the sentiment in, you know, on Twitter and all the rest of it, you see the sentiment get really bearish at really, really small pullbacks. And I'm looking at a lot of the data and I'm trying to obviously assess like how bad is it? And you're like, you know, one of my sayings is I love seeing the narratives on Twitter not playing out in the data. And I keep looking at the data, I'm like, it's not that bad, right? The losses aren't that bad. People seem to be buying the dip. And I've been trying to work out why is sentiment so shot? And I remember back in 2023, this is pre-ETFs, I had a lot of conversation with people saying that, yeah, we actually expected that we'd get Bitcoin go. We believed the bottom was in. Bitcoin would go, Ethereum would follow, and then the shitcoin waterfall would flow all the way down out the long tail. A lot of people got stuck buying ETH at the bottom, not Bitcoin. And what actually happened there is I think Ethereum is going through a very fundamental structural and probably mostly social shift, where it's realized that it's fought Bitcoin to be money. It was always going to lose that war, but it has lost that war now. Bitcoin moved 10% the other day, right, when it got to an all-time high. It moved, that 10% move in one daily candle was 40% of ETH's market cap. Like, they're not the same thing anymore. They're just the divergence between them. And if you want to see why the flippening ain't happening for Bitcoin, just do Bitcoin's market cap minus Ethereum's market cap. The magnitude just continues to grow. We're over trillions of dollars now, right? So it's much, much bigger than that thing. Now, a lot of people have bought Ethereum thinking that they were going to get that classic capital rotation. And what I think we're actually seeing is it's a lot more of a, for want of a better term, a stock picker's market where, oh no, it was actually Solana that went. Oh, it was actually this one that went. Oh, it was this particular meme coin. So to kind of round this whole thing out, when I look at why sentiment was so bad, it's because too many people are under-allocated to Bitcoin, right? That's slowly going to start changing. But I actually think a vast majority of crypto Twitter, so to speak, was massively under-invested in Bitcoin, massively over-invested in Ethereum, and probably massively over-invested in the meme coin that didn't go up, right? So I think sentiment was shot because people actually didn't hold the correct asset, which is kind of wild. And sorry, I would also put in that bucket people who experimented for the first time with options and bought a bunch of MicroStrategy call and now realizing that the market has to go well above your strike before expiration if you're going to make any money. So I think a lot of people have just bought the wrong things. And even though we're in a bull market and Bitcoin's at 106,000 as we speak, a lot of people have underperformed it. And Ethereum's a special case because it tried to be Bitcoin. It was never going to win that war and it lost it. And in that time, it's forgotten to do what it is supposed to do, which is be an execution layer. And then Solana's basically come in, just been faster, quicker, cheaper. And look, it doesn't matter whether it's the incentives of Trump's advisors, whatever it is, they launched the meme coin on Solana. Wind back the clock 12 months, 24 months, you would have a hard time convincing me. I have a hard time convincing anyone that if Trump was going to launch a meme coin 2 years ago, it would not have been on Solana. It definitely would have been on Ethereum. The fact that that has flipped is, I think there's just a recognition going on. So my view, look, I'm as a Bitcoiner, I don't, even though I think Ethereum's got its challenges, I don't particularly want to see a $400 billion asset go to zero. That's not a good result, right? I would rather these things actually produce something valuable. I don't think they will, but I don't really want that kind of value to go to zero. But I think there's a lot of Ethereans who are now realizing that with a PE ratio of 675 or whatever valuation metric you want to do, if you take the PE ratio of Ethereum down to Google at 20, which is also relatively high, it's a $100 ETH price. So like people have got to find a reason to justify these numbers now. And I think it's getting increasingly difficult.
That's a really good point. Alex Leishman just tweeted like an hour ago. He said, daily reminder that ETH has no actual value accrual narrative.
Yes.
Like there's no reason to accumulate it. There's no reason to hold it in the long term. And we're seeing right now, like there are leadership challenges at Ethereum, which just you don't hear about Bitcoin. There is no board of directors, right? There is no team that's steering the ship. It's all the nodes. And so I think, you know, exactly what you said, and that's a really good point. Even though, and I'll ask you about human greed in a second, because I don't know who wouldn't be happy with an asset that has like a 30% CAGR over 4 years. It's Bitcoin, right? It's never been lower than 24%. Right now it's at, you know, 30, 35%. It seems like a lot of people, maybe new entrants, maybe people who've played cycles before, who've thought, okay, great, bull market is here. I'm going to allocate more heavily into, you know, my alt plays. I'm going to allocate more into Ethereum, Solana, and the like. But this time that just didn't happen. This time, you know, Bitcoin took off like a rocket ship while these alts really, really struggled. And it seems like now there's so much infighting. People are just dropping Ethereum entirely. They're removing it from their handles. So I guess it's like, you know, it's a two-pronged question. Why on earth do you think that Ethereum didn't perform as well as, or perform better than Bitcoin? It's underperformed. This is the first bull market where it's done that or done that to a major extent. And B, why is there so much greed out there that people aren't happy with a 30% growth rate in the asset that they own?
Yeah, but both really good questions. I'll touch on the second one first. I think that it really comes down to that financial nihilism thing, right? If you run this experiment of fiat debasement long enough, people just don't make enough money, right? You can argue with your boss. I remember as an engineer, I would try and get a raise and, you know, they would basically, I'd deliver a big project and everything went very well. And like, everyone's very happy with the results. And I remember saying like, you know, can we discuss salary? And they're like, yeah, we can. But the challenge is in the grade you're in, right? From graduate all the way to associate, in the grade that you're in, you're basically at the top range. If we pay you more, people, when they're doing bids, they're going to say that you're actually, why is this guy too expensive, right? When they're pricing these things up. So I realize that like you can't keep going back and saying, hey, I need a 10% raise every single year. It just doesn't work. So your salary does not keep up. And as a result, people have to go further and further and further out the risk curve. And eventually we get to gambling because it's kind of the only way that people feel like they can get ahead, especially younger people. So that's a really unfortunate, that's just like the end state of fiat. I think it gets worse before it gets better, but this is why sports gambling and all this stuff is up as well. So for Ethereum specifically, I think that value accrual mechanism, and John Pfeffer wrote about this a long time ago. I think it was like 2017, he wrote a paper on this on utility coins. And I value the petrol in my car in the sense that it gets me from A to B, but I certainly don't have barrels of petrol sitting out in my backyard being like, I need to stockpile this shit. Like, that's not really how I think about it, right? Now, maybe one day we're going to have a shortage, but at the end of the day, it's kind of, if you're going to price this thing based on gas, so to speak, you really only need as much, you don't need to hold a great stockpile of it. When we look at the layer two roadmap, I mean, I don't know if anyone's ever used it, but the user experience of going between L2s, just honestly get one of your friends who's not into crypto to just explain it to them and they'll walk away, right? No one wants to touch this stuff. I don't want to touch this stuff. I've been in this industry for years. I've used Ethereum for many, many years and I've used all the DeFi protocols and all that stuff. And eventually I just realized that, you know what, I actually don't need any of this stuff. And when I really like took an honest look at what I used it for, it was to speculate on more tokens. I never actually used it for anything that improved my life. It was part of that first topic of, I was speculating on shitcoins because I thought they were going to go up. So that I kind of realized I don't need any of the products. And, you know, Ethereum has scaled into this wide web of L2s. And yes, Base is getting usage, but guys, Base is Coinbase. It's, you know, it's kind of an extension of Coinbase. So yes, Coinbase is doing fantastically. But the problem is all these chains are kind of anchoring data into Ethereum and people claim, oh, that's going to, you know, they're going to have fees and that's going to go up. And it's like, guys, as soon as your fees go up, they're going to move to some other data layer. They don't need the magnitude of, and this is my contrarian point. I think Ethereum is too decentralized, which is contrary to what Bitcoiners say, which is that it's centralized. It has centralized forces for sure, but it's actually too decentralized. They have over-designed the ship to handle what is ultimately stablecoins. Tron does a much better job. Solana does a much better job because the magnitude of the ship that's carrying the cargo is the same level of security as the cargo that it's holding, right? Mm. So Ethereum has over-designed the cannons to protect something that Tether can just freeze with a single transaction. So I think that's a key component of this whole thing. And at the end of the day, if you really look at that value accrual mechanism, Solana's going to face this as well. I use the analogy that in 2017, a very large chunk of Bitcoin demand was to buy BTC to then speculate on shitcoins at Binance. It was the base pair. In the 2020 and 21 cycle, you had to buy ETH to yield farm and DeFi and all that kind of stuff. ETH was the casino chip to go and play in the casino. Solana is now that, and eventually it'll be XYZ. That would continue to go down the risk curve. But ultimately, once that demand for the casino chip goes away and stablecoins effectively come in and take that away, Bitcoin has maintained its value capture via other mechanisms. Ethereum is struggling. I believe Solana will struggle as well, right? Once the cycle plays out, I think we'll go through the exact same phase. I doubt any of these meme coins will survive any long-term kind of market. And as a result, you don't need the casino chip to buy the thing that's going down. So I just think, you know, at the end of the day, you kind of come back to, I just fill up my car when I need it.
Extremely well said. Yeah, you know, eventually, right, these casino tokens will run down. For now, Solana does the best job at being that casino token. But in the same way that memes come and go, you know, every 2 or 3 weeks, so do these meme coins, right? And if you don't catch it immediately, it's completely worthless. But, you know, as you said, that financial nihilism. And, you know, I will say a lot of it, like the lion's share of my peers are still living with their parents. I'm 23, still living with their parents, you know, renting, if they can, a tiny one bedroom as far away from the city as they can to afford it. You know, they can barely save anything after their student loans. The prospect of owning a home with 7.5% mortgage rates is just so far away. It's so unrealistic. And that financial nihilism that you speak about, it also explains the rise of things like Barstool Sports, right? The rise of other, you know, gambling platforms, DraftKings, Stake, whatever. People are essentially just buying a lottery ticket, you know, on the hopes that they'll be able to gain financial freedom rather than doing it gradually, steadily over time into an asset that is outpacing monetary inflation to an extreme degree like Bitcoin, but it does it slower. Instead of working to understand that and slowly allocate to it over time, they're just going down to the Encore Casino over the weekend and, you know, putting in their entire paycheck.
Yeah, that's the ticket. And that's the thing. It takes time. And, you know, I still can't. I mean, I'm Bitcoin full time. I write a whole newsletter analyzing this thing. I've managed to convince probably about 3 of my friends to actually like hold a meaningful chunk. And once they get there, they fully get it. They're fully invested. But then I just can't get most people to understand, like, oh, it's too volatile. Oh, so it's like, yeah, but you have to understand, if you keep buying it, I was talking about this the other day, like, you know, I went down at 40,000, I got out. It's like, yeah, but what's the price now? Like 170. I was like, yeah, that's the point. You've got to keep buying this thing and hang on to it, because that's kind of how these things play out. If you continue to build a position, it takes a long time to build that position. It's that consistency, make it like a bill, just continue to stack sats. If you don't do that, then the results will eventually speak for themselves, which is, you know, you get a 3 or 4% on some kind of, you know, growth ETF if you're lucky.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. I'm going to shift gears back into Bitcoin. You tweeted out yesterday that the Bitcoin choppiness index is fully gassed and it's ready to trend. Back in late November, you said that we likely had several weeks of choppy consolidation before we trended away from the $100,000 level meaningfully, like sustainably. And right now, the choppiness index being exhausted signals that potentially we've arrived. I'm going to put the choppiness index on screen for viewers at home and post. I'll also share the screen now so that way you can see it. But what is the choppiness index? What does it mean for Bitcoin to be exhausted? Because, you know, and what does this mean for where we are in the cycle? Because a lot of viewers will know this, some might not, but you totally called the entire summer of 2024 to a T. You said, look, we're going to be in for, you know, months of chop solidation, like buckle up. It's going to be very boring. You know, once we get out of the summer and we have more of these catalysts, we'll probably move higher. And you were completely right. And so, you know, for viewers at home, you know exactly what you're talking about here. What is the choppiness index and what is it telling us now?
Yeah, so the choppiness index is it's an interesting metric. It's purely technical. So it's a technical indicator. It's actually the only one I use. And I learned about it from my market mentor, Doc Severson, who taught me pretty much everything I know about how markets trade, market psychology, and all that fun stuff. So the choppiness index was originally developed for commodities. And the idea is that assets like to trend. And, you know, we always talk about a trending market and then consolidation. Markets go up, then they go sideways, they go down, then they go sideways. And, you know, they kind of adhere to the laws of gravity. If you just have a market going up vertically forever, you're probably going to come back down vertically. So what the choppiness index does, now I use for the, you use it across multiple time frames. It's non-directional, which I love. I actually love non-directional metrics because it's telling me information about the market, and then I have to make a decision on which way I think it's going to go. So it's a non-directional metric. It basically, when you've got, I use a 10-day period for the monthly and the weekly, or a 10-week, 10-month. It looks at the last 10 candles, right? And it looks at the highs, the lows, and how many of the highs, lows, and closes are all within the same range. So when you've got a trending market, just imagine a candle stacked on top of each other, trending higher or trending lower, it's running out of gas. It runs for 10 weeks in one direction, the choppiness index will deplete its energy. And for this case, you can look at it on the weekly and the monthly. The weekly was exhausted in when we just got to 100K, right? So that's telling me that if we've got 10 weeks of trending upwards, the market's completely exhausted, it probably needs something on the order of about 6 to 8 to 10 weeks of chopping sideways or correcting. Because if the market corrects, you're going to backfill the candles on the way up. So you're putting more range within the previous trend. Now, you mentioned back in 2024, it was in March, we had the monthly signal was exhausted. So we trended from FTX all the way up to 73K, and the monthly choppiness index was exhausted. That then tells me we've probably got something in the order of 6 to 8 months of time to chop around, correct, go sideways, and just recharge the batteries. So if you kind of look at these things in context, we had the monthly exhausted in March last year, 8 months of consolidation, that's pretty much exactly what we had, and then we had a nice rip. And that rip from 73K to 100 in November, that exhausted, that only brought down the monthly by about half. We've still got half a tank of gas, right? So that tells me the monthly probably still wants to keep going, but the weekly was exhausted. So that's that saying, like, within the context of a monthly uptrend that still has gas in the tank, we probably just need to chop around for 6 to 8 weeks and then we can press on and go. And look, we are fully gassed at the moment. This thing is not a perfect pinpoint metric. It's just telling me that I can now start looking for signals of starting to trend again. You know, it's not supposed to be perfectly precise. It's all about relative value. Like, where is the trend in terms of its gravity? Right now, it looks like we're gassed and ready to go. We could go in both directions. We could trend down. That could just as easily happen. Based on my assessment, I think it's more likely we want to head higher. You know, certainly the market has chopped around and is ready to move once again.
Gotcha. That's fantastic. So, you know, the market started to move, non-directional metric. It could really go either way. You talked about, you know, another post, Bitcoin cyclicality. Chances are we go higher, right? And we'll talk about that in a moment. But would you also say, I don't know if you know, obviously as analysts, we have to put on our thinking cap and think about risk factors the other direction, right? So for you, what are some risk factors that this isn't necessarily pointing to Bitcoin continuing to go higher, but actually we're in for a correction? Is there anything in your mind that says Bitcoin could move lower before it moves higher?
Yeah, I think the really important thing to pay attention to, I mean, I believe that Q1 is going to be choppy. The world has to adjust to a very, very different president, very, very different policies. I am of a view that Trump's going to try and get a lot of stuff done that the system that B isn't prepared for. I also believe that he's not going to get a fraction of what he thinks he's going to get done because the system that B will push back. So you're kind of going to get this ebbing and flowing of what does happen, what doesn't happen. The world's going to have to adjust to this. If you start putting tariffs on, you know, Mexico and Canada and China, that's going to change the way the world has to operate. Things are going to have to adjust and move. So there's a lot of macro factors. That's a political side, but the macro side, I mean, bond yields are on the long end are pushing higher. That's like a selling off of the cornerstone, the foundational block that sits underneath the global economy. That's not a good thing. The dollar is really strong. That's also not a great thing, right? All of these things are actually net drains on liquidity and actually should be softening markets overall. But then you've also got to counter that with the tailwind of an administration that's openly not hostile to Bitcoin. So, you know, the world's got to adjust to all this stuff. So Q1, I think, is probably going to be relatively choppy. In terms of risk factors, I mean, I did a piece a little while back. The way I look at things, I don't actually make calls because I think making calls is kind of useless. The way that I think about things is I try to help people have made your decision in both directions before it happens. Because at the end of the day, the market is going to do what the market's going to do. None of us can control it. It's like the tide. If you swim against it, you will get dragged out to sea. the only thing you can control is your decisions. So when we're chopping around in this range, I looked underneath us and there's this big air, I call it an air pocket. Basically, no supply, very little supply has changed hands between 73K and 86K. It's like an air gap where there's, and if you look at like a volume profile, those things tend to be like a magnet, right? We've also got things like the short-term cost basis is sitting right at the top of that, about 89K or 88K. So there's a whole lot of things where like, I'd love to see that zone tested, but I've already made my decision. Even if I prepare my tool, if we go down, I would not be surprised if we get down into the, well into the 80s, because that's just, the market wants to test that demand zone. If we don't get there, that's fine. I put that tool to the side. I thought about it for a day. I had it in my back pocket. So if I wake up one day and I see Bitcoin with an 8 handle, I know my decision already. I'm going to buy it because I believe that's going to be a defended level. So I've already made that decision, even if I don't need to make it. I've then got on the other side of the equation. If we trend higher, I've got a piece where I start to look at, okay, well, where do we hit some kind of topping zone? And everyone wants to know where the cycle top is, right? It's like the biggest question I get all the time. And my answer to you is, which top? Which top matters to you? Because if you're a trader and you're playing around with leverage on the 10-minute chart, the top that matters is probably the one that just peaked and liquidated your account. That's the one that mattered for you. If you're a retiree, the top that matters for you is the one that gives you the next 3 years of runway so that you can live your life and continue to enjoy things. If you're a sat stacker, the top that matters to you is probably the one that precedes a four-year long bear market. So understanding what top actually matters for you is so much more important than trying to find the top, because you know there's going to be lots of tops. And you know, my framework is at the moment, you know, I look at areas where the average investor is really in profit, you know, MVRV and those kind of things. When does the average guy historically, when do they really start to take massive profits and oversaturate the market? The bottom of that, let's call it like a topping cloud, is like 120K. That's where we start to get where the average guy is really quite profitable. And then 150 is when almost every metric is going to be overheated. So I now have to make a decision and go, well, what do I think is going to happen there? Well, if we get to 150K, we can blow through it, of course, but we've only done so for 4% of all trading days, statistically speaking. If we go to 150, you know, let's just say we get to somewhere like that, do I see an 80% correction? It's really hard for me to see an 80% coming off 150, right? If you go 80% from 100, you're down to 20K. I'm just not seeing this happening. So therefore, I have to start thinking about, okay, if we get to 150, I'm probably not a buyer in the short term, right? Because for me, my price is much, much higher. So my decision is I'm just not going to buy at 150, right? I don't want to buy the top. I want to just let the thing do its thing. But then I have to look at the bear market and say, well, what if our bear markets are different? What if we get a 40% correction? Or a 35 or maybe a 50, something like that. What if we get something in that range and people are looking for the 80 and they kind of miss what really goes on? What if we get a 35% correction? It takes 8 months, 9 months, 12 months to play out, but people are expecting an 80% that takes 2 years. And then they get left at the station. Then people go, did the cycle end? Is it a super cycle? Was that a bear? Was that the top? Where do you measure things from? What if our metrics start to break? So that's where I'm now looking at, is going, how do I shift my thinking to what might happen? Because I don't know what's going to happen. What might happen and how will I evolve my thinking ahead of time, but as the data starts to come in?
Extremely well said. It's not about calling levels. It's about thinking probabilistically, right? Using both cycles and where we think we're going based on the current relative size of this asset to think probabilistically, right? Not saying, you know, any specific levels, because as you mentioned, it differs for everybody, right? The top Absolutely. For a day trader is different from the top for a retiree. Extremely well said. I want to shift gears into, you know, you mentioned at the very start, over the next couple of months, the world is going to have to digest and the market is going to have to digest an entirely new leader of the free world, right? Someone who wants to do things in a radically different way from the incumbent administration, someone who's going to get a lot of it done, but a lot of it's going to be, you know, he's going to be roadblocked by Congress in order to do it. And so Trump yesterday just signed, I believe in the order of like 120 to 150 executive orders, memorandums, and other things, which totally blows any other prior president out of the water. So he's already storming out the gate saying that, all right, I'm back here. I know I don't have to get elected again. I don't have to play it safe anymore. I can, you know, go balls to the wall, right? We'll just say balls to the wall. And so he clearly, you know, he wants to get done what he said on the campaign trail. He's putting out all these EOs. You know, at the same time, we have this regime change in the SEC. You know, they're trying to establish a much more, you know, pro Bitcoin, pro crypto environment here stateside. In your eyes, do you think you know, will this move the needle at all? Are these efforts genuine? Were they simply to buy voters in the near term? Or do you think that what Trump did by putting Scott Bessent in, you know, the Treasury Secretary position, huge pro-crypto guy, do you think he's really serious about this? And if he is, do you think that it's enough to move the needle for Bitcoin?
Yeah, look, so this is kind of getting into the realm of the Bitcoin stockpile slash reserve, and I think we should make a distinction there. I think the stockpile is holding what they have, the reserve is buying more. I think the stockpile is likely because, as you said, he's in there, he's made promises, right? I mean, more important than anything is to free Ross, so that's promise number one for the Bitcoin crowd. Number two, if you want to do the stockpile, okay, fine, that's great. For me personally, I think the reserve is very unlikely. Just because it's got to go through all the Congress side of things. It's a real challenge to do that. I think it will move the needle in terms of there will be less hostile for sure. No question. I think it's probably better for the crypto world on a relative balance because they're going to get ETFs filed for every shitcoin under the sun. That's going to happen and Bitcoin's going to have to get used to it. I said this when the Ethereum ETF went live. I said, do I believe that the Ethereum ETF, it puts it on an even playing field. And what I think we're going to discover is that the rankings that we've had forever where Bitcoin is unflipped is... You know, the ETF for all these other assets don't change that mix, right? Bitcoin's going to be just fine. They're all going to have to fight amongst themselves. And in fact, a topping signal that I mentioned in my recent video, something to just be aware of, I think there is a very real possibility that Ethereum is challenged at the number two spot this cycle, whether because it falls and others rally or they just rally harder, whatever it is. I think Ethereum might get challenged. I have a feeling that the topping signal, when you're looking for like the most overheated environment, imagine Ethereum is 10% away from being flipped by something. Imagine the speculation on everyone trying to take that number two spot. That is going to be a speculative fever if it happens. And that to me is one signal of, hey guys, we are really late stage in this thing. That's not a good thing. So anyway, look, I think that overall, you mentioned Scott Bessent, right? He's obviously a very, very qualified man to do the job. Look, how important is Bitcoin? Right. And we know Bitcoin's very important. How important is Bitcoin relative to just the fact that the bond market is trading almost at 5%? It's just not. It's just not, guys. And, you know, if you really play this out, even if they bought a decent chunk of Bitcoin, it has to go so high up. The price has to go so high up, which it will, but it has to go so high. $36 trillion is a gargantuan number. It is so big. It is so unbelievably big. It's just not happening, right? This whole idea if we're going to buy Bitcoin and pay off the debt, you're kidding yourselves. It's just, there's no chance. As Luke Gromer would say, right? Stick a couple of zeros on the end of gold and Bitcoin, and it's still probably not going to fix the problem, right? It's just not going to fix the problem. So I think Bessent understands the bond market, and I think he understands, you know, he understands all the pieces of the puzzle. Yes, understanding Bitcoin is a good thing. I don't think it has that much of a role in terms of why he's there. He's there to solve the bond market. That is the real problem that they've got. They've got to find buyers. They've got to manage. I mean, Yellen was issuing on the short end rather than the long end. They can't do that forever. I heard someone talking about this the other day. It might have been Bill Fleckenstein. He was basically saying it's like payday lending, right? If you're going to all these stablecoin issuers and saying, hey, let's issue these short-term treasuries, you're kind of getting a payday loan to fund the US government. That can't go on forever. So they've got all sorts of challenges going on. I think he's there for the bond market. I think Bitcoin's a fun story, but relatively speaking, it's kind of irrelevant.
He certainly is. Yeah, we're facing this cataclysmic problem in the U.S. Interest expense is the second largest line item on our budget. You know, if you look at Social Security and Medicaid, number one, interest expense number two. And so it's absolutely catastrophic that I'm looking at my terminal right now. Tens are at 4.57%. Granted, they're down like 25 basis points over the last month, but 4.57%, the average coupon on notes and bonds for the U.S. Treasury market right now on you know, outstanding debt is 2.8%. Right. So we're talking almost, you know, 200 basis points higher than what we're paying now if we have to roll all this stuff. That's the real problem he's there for, not Bitcoin. And so this also speaks to, and this is one thing I, you know, I can riff on and I also want to get your thoughts on, is everybody is steaming that day one we didn't get anything related to Bitcoin, you know, in the inaugural address, which obviously
there's your signal, by the way.
But no Bitcoin stuff in the EOs that he did yesterday. And I'm like, obviously he wouldn't. Like, obviously he wouldn't. You know, I tweeted out, you know, he's going to repeal SAB 121 via executive order. And it did, you know, the tweet did insanely well. There's such a hunger for this stuff. But people were so shocked that it didn't happen on day one. I'm like, well, obviously, like, you know, we have millions of people flooding into the country. We have all of these other huge wide scale issues. Do you really think Trump is, you know, chiefly concerned with repealing this accounting policy put forward, you know, by the Fed? Like, it's totally nuts. And so Do you think people's expectations are way too high for, you know, obviously he is an avowedly pro-Bitcoin president, but do you feel that given yesterday's reaction to no Bitcoin-related executive orders, do you think people's expectations are too high for what he's going to do?
I mean, of course they are. You know, like just because you're posting on Twitter with Trump with a Bitcoin logo behind him doesn't mean he gives that much of a shit about Bitcoin, you know? Like, you got him voted in. Well done. Like, that's welcome to politics. You got... You know, you kind of got used, but that's what politicians do. They use their populace. Now, that doesn't mean he's not going to be pro all of these things, right? It just means that they're so far down the priority list. It just doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Like, 100%. Go to the average American, right, and say, okay, Trump's come in. He's just gone and bought a million Bitcoin. He spent whatever money that requires to do that. And they're going, I don't have a job. Like, where the hell is my, like,
wait
I'm
a minute, my tax dollars are going to buying Bitcoin? What on earth?
It's just not happening, guys. Like, you know, like, you got to think about the average American. Literally going to ask the average American, it's just not happening. Bitcoin is not on their radar. They want jobs. As you mentioned, they got problems with immigration. They got problems with so many things that simply aren't Bitcoin. So I think absolutely, we live in our own little echo chamber and it's very easy to get caught up in that stuff. That's why I've been very measured about all these things. It's like, the financial world gets this, but That's they're only just working this stuff out. The Saab 121 thing is actually quite significant. That's a big deal, because if they do actually repeal that, suddenly you get the banks come in, they want to custody it. That's a new line of business. That's massive, right? That's huge. They've seen BlackRock clip the ticket. They're going to clip the ticket too. All these things are going to happen. Bitcoin lending will happen. It's going to reach that status of neutral reserve asset, pristine collateral. All of these things are going to happen. It's quite clear that's going in that direction. It's not, and I think this is something to just keep in mind, everybody who's listening. It's going to be really easy, and it's human psychology to do this, to take all the big information that you hear, Trump is a pro-Bitcoin president and reserves and all this stuff, and then apply it to the next daily candle. And it is just as easy to take the last 5-minute candle and apply it to the monthly trend, right? So try not to get your time frames incorrect. That's actually why I think the choppiness index is really cool, because it helps me frame up my time frames. If you take small time frame stuff and you apply it to the big scale, you're going to be wrong. If you take really long term, big, slow macro things and you expect it to happen tomorrow, you're probably going to be wrong, right? I did a study probably about 6 months ago where I looked at Bitcoin's price performance from a statistical standpoint. 40% of the time, Bitcoin price goes less than 1% in either direction, aka nowhere. 40% of the time, Bitcoin goes nowhere. 30% of the time it goes up more than 1%, 30% of the time it goes down more than 1%. So if you're a day trader, right, this is why day traders get wrecked. If you go long, there's only a 30% chance it goes up. There's a 40% chance it goes nowhere and a 30% chance it goes down. You've got 70% odds against you. This is why day traders don't make it. But if you run that study on a quarterly basis, there's a massive positive skew and some of those quarters are plus 100%. So the idea is that most of the time Bitcoin goes nowhere. Sometimes it goes up a lot. Sometimes it goes down a lot, but it goes up a lot more. So you just got to be there for it, right? Sit tight and just enjoy the ride.
This is fantastic. You know, so far we've had two huge reframings of, you know, what Bitcoin is as an asset. The first thing, it's not a get rich quick scheme. It's a get rich slow scheme, right? It's not a scheme. Get rich slow. That's the objective of Bitcoin. And number two is that a lot of the time Bitcoin does nothing. And then, you know, a great deal of the time, the majority of the time, it goes up and it goes up by a lot. And so that's fascinating. It especially clashes with this notion that Bitcoin is this hugely volatile asset when you actually look at the data, which you have done and found that, look, Bitcoin most of the time, like a lot of the time, 40% of the time, it does nothing, right? 30% of the time it goes down, you know, more than 1%, 30% of the time it goes up 1% or more, right? But over these longer time horizons, right, it's the best performing asset, right? Largely the best macro performing asset. I have a question for you. Today, the South African central bank governor, he scoffed at the idea of a strategic Bitcoin reserve. I'm not sure if you saw the tweet, but he said something to Sam Callahan put it out. He said something to the tune of, why would we establish a strategic Bitcoin reserve? Why not an Apple reserve or a beef reserve or a platinum reserve? And so I guess that's a, you know, a funny example, but more often than not, we have a lot of people. You mentioned you've only been able to orange pill a handful. I've only orange pilled one person in my life. That's been my mom, because, you know, she'd seen that I've been doing this for several years and she just finally got convinced that it's something
worthwhile. She finally bet on her son.
Exactly. After all this time. And so it's the most widespread notion of all that people just don't recognize the value prop of Bitcoin. They can't distinguish it from any other asset. And so like, if you had to explain it to someone, how is Bitcoin different from any other asset? And then why is it valuable because of those differences?
Yeah, it's very interesting. And like the game theory of the sovereign nation state, you could very reasonably apply and say, well, why do I buy Bitcoin? It's like, because I know it's going to be around at the end of this storm. I know that it's scarce. I understand it. I can send it anywhere in the world. Like, it gives me freedom. It lets me sleep at night. As a company, and we own a company, we've got a Bitcoin treasury reserve. Our company, it also, because, you know, we're playing that Bitcoin goes through booms and busts and all that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, we are also trying to pay ourselves long term. So we want to have a treasury reserve so that when we're old and gray, we have this kind of income stream. So we're saving the capital that we don't need now to be used many, many years in the future, right? At some point, I'm going to want to retire. And it will be nice to have this kind of asset that I can just kind of peel off and pay the two of us over the long term. As a country, doesn't that same concept apply? So, you know, there's like just the simple financial performance. And I was listening to another podcast yesterday, I think, and they were talking about gold. And I think they did just like very arbitrary, like, you know, I measured this and this over X amount of years, and it had the same purchasing power. And I've been a big believer of this, that gold maintains your purchasing power. You put $1,000 into gold, it'll be worth $1,000 of purchasing power whenever you need it. Mm-hmm. For Bitcoin, it's going to grow that by an unknown amount. You are going to have more than $1,000 into the future, which is actually why I think you need both in the portfolio, because they service different roles, different parts of that growth trajectory. So for a country, you know, they look at the gold reserve that the US have, and I think TXMC and I had a conversation about this. It's kind of a relic of the past, those gold reserves. You know, case in point, that's still, as far as I'm aware, the gold is still valued at $42. Kind of shows you that it is, in fact, just a relic of the past. Now, there's some treasury accounting tricks where they can revalue it to the current spot price, and, you know, deposits money in the TGA and all those different things. But at the same time, as a country, you know, if you look at Bitcoin, I mean, obviously apples, you can't save in apples, right? We've all read the Bitcoin standard. You kind of understand that, well, the apples perish. The gold and the Bitcoin don't perish. That's first and foremost. You can grow more apples. You can't grow more Bitcoin and gold. They're much, much harder to actually inflate the supply of. So as a savings vehicle, it makes sense. The question is, do countries need to have those savings vehicles? And if you kind of think about this, and I like to, when I look at big problems like this, you have to understand that there's what should happen and there's what is most likely going to happen. And the unfortunate reality is that we're in a scenario right now where we've got a set of initial conditions, and that is $36 trillion worth of debt. That is a long end that's selling off. There's the initial conditions. It would be great to have a Bitcoin reserve. It'd be great to have a much bigger gold reserve. It'd be great to be buying things and putting them into your savings account. But we're looking at things from today. You've got to make decisions given your initial conditions today. Now, we're seeing this globally, right? We're seeing China and Russia, and they're all moving towards a gold standard because they have a risk of the US freezing their reserves and all those things. So there is certainly that happening around the world. I think overall, the neutral reserve asset is going to happen. I think it makes all the sense in the world from a sovereign nation state. Countries will work this out sooner than others. I think the US is in a really interesting position as a global reserve currency issuer, in the sense that saving in something that's not the dollar is kind of a vote against their own system. So it's a really tricky scenario, and I don't fully know how they're going to navigate it. But what I do know is that between now and the navigated point, there will be a lot more fiat currency in the world, in all denominations. So that's just kind of my base case, is that in order to get there, people have to go through a lot of pain before they change the system. And I was actually talking about this to my mate yesterday. Here in Australia, we have it's pretty good here in Australia, right? The pain level that we're feeling here is not yet at the level that we're seeing in the UK. It's not yet what we're seeing in Canada. It's not yet what we're seeing in the US in terms of where society is at, but we're getting there. So I think that we aren't quite there, and you'll actually see this in the politics. We're seeing a shift in Canada right now. We're probably going to see a big shift in the UK. We're going to have our election here in Australia this year, actually, in May. We'll see if there's early signs of a shift here, but I think we're probably one election cycle away from going through this kind of, you know, move back towards the right kind of side, more conservative, more fiscally responsible. Well, maybe that's a stupid word in terms of politics, but, you know, I think Australia's got to go through a lot more pain before we get there. And I'm often amazed how much pain society will take when it comes to inflation. Look at Argentina. Look at the amount of pain they had to go through, but they finally put a guy in there who could actually fix some of these problems. So human beings can go through a lot before we decide to make the shift. And it's got to be a big shift. It's got to be a societal one. And, you know, each country's at a different level there.
Absolutely. And it also reminds me of the people who say Bitcoin will go to $1 million in the next 4 years. In order for that to happen, there would need to be a systemic collapse on the scale that we've never seen in recorded history, bigger than the fall of Rome, for that to need to happen. It might sound great, but then you understand the conditions under which that would need to happen, like a complete and total collapse of the US dollar, hyperinflation. It's not very good. And so while we know this asset's going there in 10, 20, 30 years, you don't want it tomorrow, right? You certainly don't want it tomorrow. I want to round out the episode talking about some of your most recent posts. And for viewers of the show, go to checkonchain.com, click on the newsletter button, check these posts out. You'll be able to read them in their full length, but we'll take some excerpts from them here. One of your more recent posts, you likened this current cycle to 2016 and 2017, specifically with short-term holder MVRV and short-term holder SOPR. I'm going to throw one of the charts up on screen right now. We'll start with MVRV. This is in a section you call Deja Vu. So going through these two charts, what are the similarities you're viewing between this cycle and the 2017 cycle?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I was talking with my analyst over at Glassnode the other day, and we were talking about what's our favorite stupid chart that we don't really put any stock into that we like looking at. And the one we all agreed, there's that one where you like map everything from the cycle low and you overlay how the different cycles played out in like an index curve. Yeah. And for that one there, we are right now dead on the 2016-17 cycle. We are following the exact same path. It is uncanny. It is strange. I keep saying that this four-year cycle thing is going to break, and yet here we are, word for word, following the same thing. Now, there's been a lot of comparisons. There's a fundamental side, and then there's some of the data that we're looking at here. There's a lot of comparisons between the 2016-17 and our current cycle. And actually, there's a lot of similarities between 2018 all the way through to 2022. The way I would describe 2016-17, very spot-driven. We didn't actually have derivatives. Stablecoins really weren't a significant... I think Tether existed, but it's tiny. It was a very spot-driven market. There's no futures. There's no options. It's just people buying Bitcoin. Very much an adoption-driven cycle. I wasn't there. Unfortunately, I bought the top of that cycle. But I really want to experience a parabola like that, because probably one of the most epic price parabolas that will ever exist.
Neither was I, unfortunately. I was working on
Dunkin' Donuts at the time. It's brutal. So I'm really hoping that this cycle continues to look the same. But the framework here is that every dip was bought, but every dip was quite severe, and it came back down, retested the short-term holder cost basis, which is what we can see here. So the MVRV ratio is basically looking at where is price relative to the average cost basis of recent buyers. That's what we're looking at. And you can see that on the left-hand side, every time it comes down and retests that blue line, that's the neutral level where people are at their cost basis. It goes a little bit below, which is good because you need to shake out the people who bought at the top. They usually capitulate. People come in, step in, buy the dip, and away we go. And it's interesting because we don't get to extreme levels. When you get to the late stage of a bull, you get to these really blown out levels where just everyone's happy, parabolic. It's when it's too overheated. It took all of 2016 and half of 2017 before that started to happen. We are in a very much the same environment, right? We're getting these nice moderate rallies, nice corrections. Moderate rallies, cool down. Moderate rally, cool down. If you then look at the mid zone between 2018 and 2022, big bust to the downside, big boom to the upside in 2019. Big bust to the downside in March 2020, big boom to the upside in 21, and then a horrible bear market in 2022. Very like transitionary, unstable, like trying to find out what am I worth? I don't know. Like stuff was changing. The world was kind of restructuring and Bitcoin was just responding to that, right? You got everything from plus token Ponzi's to macro events. You got interest rates going up and down. You've got the COVID stimulus, all that kind of stuff, the deleveraging of the whole market. There was a lot of things, events that drove that cycle. But now we're very much in this, hey, there is a reliable bid under this market. We have, again, we barely pull back 25%. Barely pull back 25. That's like we were pulling back 35, 40% back in 2016-17. Here we are. If we get 25, people are panicking. It's crazy. But that buy the dip mentality just keeps coming back in. And you know, whether you look at it from that index price performance, from MVRV, from SOAP, there's a whole range of metrics. It just looks like we're in a very similar spot-driven, true demand, little dips, step in and buy the dip. We're in that same investor behavior. It will end eventually, but right now, there's a hell of a lot of similarities between these two.
That's certainly what it seems like. This buy the dip environment, it's way more constructive. And even on smaller time frames, even when Bitcoin kind of gets over its skis, for example, like I tweeted out earlier, I took a look at the futures data. the first time we reached 106K, like OI was, you know, $2.5 billion higher than where we are now. The funding rate was like double or more than double. Now it's very muted. It's very tame. And that seems to be the story, at least as we're now at this 100K mark. Every time we've ratcheted just a little bit higher, the first time we do, it's leverage driven. The next time we do, it's much slower, much more constructive, much more spot driven. And like you said, that seems to be the story of this cycle, which is extremely encouraging. And to my mind, I think that's only going to continue being the case if SAB 121 gets repealed, if we get Bitcoin much more financialized and integrated into traditional finance. And then all of a sudden you have an even firmer structural bid under the market. Regular 25, 30, 40% corrections of Bitcoin may be a thing of the past, but at the very least, it's highly encouraging that we're now seeing a much more spot-driven, much more measured, slow and steady climb, which also could be one of the things that one of the reasons people, you know, my age view Bitcoin is boring and they want to buy Trump instead.
But it's interesting, isn't it? And actually, I would say we were talking before about altcoins, and I'd put MicroStrategy in this bucket as well. In a way, a lot of the speculative fever has gone out on the risk curve, so people don't really punt super long. Like you mentioned, funding rates. They have been cooling down very quickly. Yes, you obviously get euphoria as you come into the peaks, but for Bitcoin specifically, it doesn't seem to stick around. It cools down and really goes into a very stable pattern very quickly, which is interesting. And I can't help but wonder if a lot of that speculative fervor is actually coming out elsewhere. It's going into meme coins. People are like, oh, well, if I'm going to punt, I may as well properly punt. Or I'm, you know, putting all my speculative capital into MicroStrategy call options, which ultimately go to zero because call options mostly do. Most people are punting on this stuff, and you're actually not getting the sellers of Bitcoin afterwards because you don't have that many people who have bought too many coins at too high of a price. We're getting this really interesting dynamic where it's stable. It's much more stable in the spot market. It will change. Eventually, we'll get to that point. But I find that really quite interesting. Now, I think as leverage builds up, because let's not kid ourselves, these institutions are going to gamble as well. This is what they do. They're very good at it. And if you've got a large liquid portfolio and you want to take some risk, Bitcoin might be the only asset that's big enough. The ETFs might be the only place you can do it. The Bitcoin futures might be the only place you can put that kind of size on. And you got to remember that all the options. And you got to remember that these guys, they bet other people's money. They don't bet their money. They didn't have to work to get it. They have to work to keep it, but they don't have to work to get it. And as a result, they can blow up in a really big way. So, you know, keep those things in mind. Just because institutions are here doesn't mean the volatility is going to go away. I still have this feeling that we're in this really stable phase of this bull. And I do think bulls and bears are going to evolve and change. I think they're going to be different. And I think holding, even though I use models based on past performance, I'm also very, very cognizant that I think things are going to evolve and shift. So I'm always keeping my ideas fluid because I just think bears won't be the same, bulls won't be the same. People will get confused as to which one's which. And as a result, you know, that's kind of where if you understand the mechanics of what's going on under the hood, at the very least can give you a bit of a view. Make a decision. What am I going to do if it goes higher? What am I going to do if it goes lower? Just have those decisions in your back pocket and you'll be way better off.
Absolutely. Think probabilistically. Bitcoin may not be the casino du jour that it used to be. They're going to other stuff, but that doesn't mean volatility is gone. And it doesn't mean it's going away. One last thing. You posted 3-4 days ago a post. I think it was titled A Bullish Post. And you went, which is a fantastic title, by the way. I oftentimes spend way too much time thinking, how can I write a great title? But that's, you know, 101 right there. You went through, you compared a whole bunch of different, you know, cyclical models. You compared short-term holder MVRV, AVIV. You compared, you know, normal technical moving averages, standard MVRV. And you used it to construct this chart of topping price models. Do you think people who are calling for 200,000 Bitcoin this cycle are insane? Or do you think we'll probably see something a lot more measured, you know, like 120, 150, something like that toward the end of this cycle?
Yeah, no, this is a great question. And actually, I've got a lot of people because I'm always trying to frame things up being like, I don't know. I got no idea where we go. Now, if you think about it, we're at 106, 200,000 is not that far away. So I think that's actually the report where I showed that cyclical index chart. And basically, if we get up into the 2021 range, which is the, you know, no longer diminishing returns, I think from memory, it was like 218K. If we get to like 218K, we don't actually have diminishing returns. We're kind of in the same ballpark as 2021. So that's achievable, right? That doesn't actually sound stupid to me. Now, what I will say is that if we go to 150K, from memory, there's about 5% of all day. So if we look at all those different oscillators, I just do some simple histograms. Just look at how often does MVRV get to 2 standard deviations, 3 standard, 4 standard? How far away from the mean does it get? And when you look at that perspective, there's like 5% of all trading days that are higher than 150K. The 5% is not zero, right? 5% is not zero. And when you're in that full-scale euphoria, things can just keep going, right? So here you go. 4% of all trading days. This, just imagine you wake up tomorrow and Bitcoin has teleported to 150K. We can keep going. If we look at previous cycles, we absolutely can keep going. But it doesn't happen very often. It's an improbable event. Can happen, doesn't mean it's going to be there. What it also means is that if you're getting up into that thin air, the chances are you're probably going to backfill it, because the body of that candle that you can see there, that's where the market wants to go. Now, if it may be a bit hard for people to envision, but what this is basically looking at is where does MVRV close, right? So that, imagine an oscillator going up and down. This is showing you on the x-axis all the different values that it has been in the past and how often it does that. Now, there's two ways that you can have the candle or the current value go back in towards the body of that candle, right, where most of the population is. You can either trade sideways for a long time, where lots of people take profit, the market absorbs it, and the realized price climbs. That cools off MVRV. Sideways markets that absorb supply cools down the MVRV, because it's telling you the average person wants to buy Bitcoin at a higher price. There is demand up here that is sustainable. The other way is that the price comes down, right, and just cools the thing off directly. So these are probably a bit of both. Probably a bit of both. So there's a few different things to just pay attention here. So about 120 to 150, that is what I would call the topping cloud. We can absolutely bust out the top end of that with a very, very low probability of staying out the top end of that, right? So that's the way I like to think about it. At about 120, the average guy is quite profitable. At 150, the average guy is so profitable that in every previous cycle, he was cashing out. And above that, that's really speculative fever. And I probably would think if we go above it, we probably come back down through it. So that's kind of how I think about things. But again, I don't know. So I'm going to explore and analyze this thing as it happens. And that's part of the fun as an analyst, right? You have a thesis and you just see how the market plays and you kind of adapt and adjust as you go.
Phenomenal. And to all the viewers at home, James is hands down the best guy at doing this, changing his thesis as the market unfolds and monitoring these things in real time. So thanks so much for coming on, man. Wonderful conversation. Before we close things out, any parting thoughts and where can people find your work?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, mate. Yeah, checkonchain.com. We've got basically two products. We've got the newsletter, which is fully gated, but the idea is that it takes me time and my expertise and all that to come up with the posts. So that's basically what we charge for. But our charting suite is, at the moment, it's completely free. So you'll always have access to the data. The data is always available. All the charts are there. But obviously my time in interpreting is that's basically what we charge for. So you'll find both of those at checkonchain.com. And look, I think that the general advice I give people is don't get caught up on small daily candles and don't extrapolate it. And try and get yourself out of the framework of trying to predict anything, because none of us can. None of us can do it. We've been trying for years. None of us can predict the future. What you can do, the only thing you can control are your decisions. So have a framework for what your decisions will be before and ahead of time. That's the only thing you can control. You can't do anything about the market. The market's just going to go where it's going to go. And for the sat stackers out there, the way I like to think about things, I don't like to buy my sats when the market's overheated, there's lots of profit, there's lots of funding rate. Like when too many people are too euphoric, I don't like buying there, because every time I've done that, it's been a bad decision in the short term. So let's just imagine here we are at 100. No matter what any of us do, the destiny for Bitcoin is that we're going back to 50K. That's just what's happening. None of us can choose this. It's just going to happen one day. I would rather be buying my coins at 95 and 80 and 85, and then it goes to 50, then at 106 and 108 and 110, and then it goes to 50. You know what I mean? Like, so you can actually improve your overall cost basis by just avoiding the overheated signals, being patient, taking a step back, and just looking for when the people who do buy high, they always sell low. That's why we look at things like MVRV and SOPA. It shows when those top buyers sell low. And if you just improve every stack by 5%, 10%, 15%, compound that over your entire stacking journey. The numbers are extraordinary. So it's not about timing the market. It's just about not doing it at the wrong time and just trying to improve it. Just give yourself a 10% edge over everyone else by buying when the dumb money sells low. And this happens all the time.
absolutely. And you could very easily do that by checking out the Check On Chain suite of charts. And I will say the newsletter is certainly worth the price. So anybody listening to James's thoughts and are considering it, I would highly encourage you to check that out. James, thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks, mate. It's been a real pleasure, as always.